there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Due to the graphic nature of this murder case, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
Let's begin. First victim.
My God, so much blood. Nancy Frome, age 23. Slender build, average height.
External injuries. Significant amount of dried blood in hair and on body. Face and head badly disfigured from blunt force trauma. 8 circular scars on back of right hand, possibly inflicted by a cigar.
Internal injuries. Lungs collapsed. Heavy hemorrhaging. Stomach and diaphragm ruptured.
Cause of death, bullet wound to the left temporal region of the skull, inflicted by 32 caliber slug. All right, moving on.
Second victim, Hazel Frome, age 49, average height and build.
External injuries, face and neck severely swollen and discolored, nearly black in appearance. Deep laceration on right forearm, extending through skin and muscle.
Cause of death, bullet wound to the right temporal region. Slug is badly deformed, but likely a 38 caliber.
Conclusion. Mother and daughter appear to have been tortured over an extended period of time, then put to death by bullets fired from point blank range.
This is Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories, a Parcast original. I'm your host, Carter Roy.
And I'm your host, Wendy McKenzie. Every Tuesday, we dive into the world of a real unsolved murder and try to solve the case.
You can find episodes of Unsolved Murders and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Unsolved Murders for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Unsolved Murders in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you. Our listeners, you allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our second episode on Hazel and Nancy Frome, who were savagely murdered in Texas in 1938. Last week, we covered the disastrous road trip and events that led to Hazel and Nancy's brutal killings.
This week, we'll cover the decades-long investigation to find their murderers.
On Sunday, April 3rd, 1938, the bodies of 49-year-old Hazel Frome and her 23-year-old daughter Nancy were found in a shallow pit off of a Texas highway.
The women were socialites from the Bay Area, where Hazel's husband, Weston, was a powerful executive. He oversaw the manufacture of explosives for Atlas Powder Company, and his lucrative job allowed the family to live comfortably.
In March of 1938, Hazel and Nancy decided to drive cross-country to South Carolina to visit family. But out of nowhere, their brand new Packard broke down in El Paso, where they were stranded for 5 days while repairs were made.
The women stayed at the luxurious Hotel Cortez and made several trips across the border into Juarez, Mexico. But their already inconvenient stopover took a frightening turn when they received a threatening letter that made them all too eager to leave town.
Hazel and Nancy finally got back on the road on the morning of March 30th.
However, they disappeared that same day, only to turn up dead in a ditch 4 days later.
The hunt for the women's killers began as soon as their bodies were found. Immediately, dozens of local, state, and even federal lawmen began working the sensational case.
As law enforcement agencies set about their work, Atlas Powder Company and the governor of Texas offered a combined reward for the killers' capture that would be worth nearly $180,000 today. This huge bounty flooded the El Paso area with private eyes.
Both professional lawmen and amateur detectives were eager to solve the double murder, but this was easier said than done. From the very beginning, the investigation was plagued by disruptive challenges. For starters, no one knew who was in charge.
The initial lack of leadership led to chaotic casework and missed leads. The lack of communication and teamwork lasted for several days, and in that time, an unknown number of leads slipped through the cracks. Ironically, the leader of the bunch was not chosen until April 6th, when newspapers began referring to 41-year-old Sheriff Chris Fox of El Paso County as the coordinator of the investigation.
Following this declaration from the papers, Fox took the lead, and it soon became clear he was the right man for the job. The sheriff was both a popular and effective investigator. He had a reputation throughout the Southwest as a shrewd and determined detective.
However, in Fox's hunt for the truth, he sometimes stepped on other officers' toes. For example, a few years prior, he'd gotten into a heated jurisdictional dispute with the Texas Rangers.
Bad blood still lingered between the departments. But if there was any chance of solving the Frome case, Fox would need to work with his fellow lawmen. So Fox called a meeting with the Rangers, officers from the Texas Department of Public Safety, and fellow local sheriff Albert Anderson to clear the air and get everyone on the same page.
Thank you for joining me, gentlemen. I know we all have work to do, so I'll keep this brief. I'm setting up this office as the central gathering place for all evidence and statements. We'll keep track of everything and make sure it's available to whoever needs it. Does anyone here have any questions?
Yeah, I got a question. Why should you be in charge?
Look, fellas, I'm not here to tell anyone what to do. I'm just trying to organize things so we're not doing the same work twice. Anyone have a problem with that? All right, then. Any other questions?
Yeah, I got one. Where's Sheriff Anderson?
I invited him. Guess he found something better to do.
Like some of the Texas Rangers, Sheriff Anderson of Culberson County wasn't pleased that Fox was in charge of the Frome murders. The women's bodies had been found in Anderson's jurisdiction, and he believed this should make him the de facto leader.
So rather than attend Fox's meeting, Anderson assembled a posse and went out searching for clues on his own.
Hey, I think I found something. It's a newspaper. The San Francisco Chronicle, from last week.
Well done. Those fancy Frome ladies must have brought it with them.
The breeze probably blew it out here.
Let's head downwind, everyone.
Wait! There's some tire tracks over here.
Looks like someone was here not too long ago, and they took off in a hurry.
Hey, Sheriff! Take a look at this. I found them wrapped up in one of the papers.
Are those medical gloves?
Looks like it.
What kind of doctor would get tangled up in something like this?
Sheriff Anderson's search party found a spot where the killers had gone through Hazel and Nancy's belongings. The medical gloves at the scene suggested a doctor may have been involved in the slayings.
Anderson's decision to skip Fox's meeting had paid off. Anderson informed Fox of his discovery, but Fox still hoped to encourage teamwork, so he also invited the DPS detectives to help him inspect the Frome's car.
On April 8th, the officers went over every inch of the vehicle with magnifying glasses. The search was fruitless until a detective spotted a tiny green smudge on the Packard's right front fender. Catching this small clue was a big win.
It seemed the Packard had collided with something green, though officers had no idea what that might have been. Witnesses had testified to seeing several cars on the road the fateful day Hazel and Nancy went missing, but none of them were green.
One onlooker, Jim Milam, came forward to report his strange sighting. On March 30th, Milam saw the Frome's women in their silver Packard being chased down the highway by a man and woman in a smaller black sedan. Milam claimed the smaller car had white lettering on the passenger side, but he was too far away to read it.
Later in the day, Milam said the Packard passed him at high speed, again followed by the black car. But this time, a man drove the Packard and a woman drove the smaller vehicle. Hazel and Nancy were nowhere to be found.
Another witness, Frances Hammer, came forward to report her own observation from March 30th. Hammer had been driving down the same highway when she saw two women standing on the side of the road in front of a light-colored Packard.
A man who appeared to be helping them got out of a small black car. Hammer described him as having piercing black eyes that, quote, gave the impression of a dope fiend. While this was an intriguing description, it didn't get officers any closer to finding the source of the mysterious green smudge.
As the investigation continued in Texas, it was time to put Hazel and Nancy to rest in California. Their funeral service was held in Richmond on April 7th. Afterward, reporters were allowed a brief interview with the grieving father and husband, 49-year-old Weston Frome. He offered his own strange opinions on the case while his friend, George Thornton, facilitated the conversation.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Mr. Frome will now answer a few questions. I ask that you all be considerate during this incredibly difficult time.
Mr. Frome, what do you think about the LA Times suggesting that murderous bandits from Los Angeles could be involved in this case?
That story is nonsense. Hazel and Nancy weren't even in Los Angeles on that night. As I've said before, they stopped at a motor court in Bakersfield.
Bakersfield? But the El Paso Sheriff's Department says they stopped in L.A. Are you saying they're mistaken?
If you have any further questions, you can direct them to my friend, Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Frome is certain that Hazel and Nancy were killed by robbers who were after their nice clothes and new car. Any further speculation is just an attempt to sensationalize this tragedy. I hope that you will all respect Mr. Frome's privacy and refrain from attempting to contact him further.
Come on! You have to give us more than that.
While California reporters eagerly threw out theories that made for splashy headlines, Texas authorities stayed focused on their investigation. Sheriff Fox thought it was suspicious that Weston denied the fact that Hazel and Nancy had spent a night in Los Angeles. In fact, Weston seemed very anxious to keep investigators from looking into the West Coast at all.
This strange behavior signaled to Sheriff Fox that perhaps the Frome women's killers might have followed them all the way from California. Fox based this theory on several more key pieces of evidence.
First, there was the fact that Hazel and Nancy had been viciously tortured over an extended period of time. This seemed to indicate a personal vendetta against the Frome women, rather than a mere crime of opportunity.
Furthermore, the killers left behind valuable jewelry on the victims' bodies. This wouldn't make sense if robbery was the main motive. And finally, the murderers took the risk of stopping to go through the Frome's possessions, which suggested that they were looking for something specific.
While the sheriff found these discrepancies very interesting, the Rangers thought little of them and focused their inquiries on known criminals in the El Paso area. Soon after the investigation began, Rangers had received tips about a mysterious couple driving a small dark car through southern Texas. The vehicle had luggage piled up in the back seat and white lettering on the doors, just like the car that Milam said he saw chasing the silver Packard.
Starr County Sheriff Gus Guerra took a deputy out to investigate, and they soon came upon the mysterious car parked on the side of the road.
That's the car!
Good work! Pull over, and let's go see if we can get some answers.
Careful, Sheriff.
Damn it! They're making a break for it! Don't let them get away!
Sheriff Guerra and his deputy sped off after the black car, but it quickly outpaced them. They doubled back to where the car had been parked, and Guerra found something that suggested the investigation was finally on the right track. It was a handkerchief monogrammed with the letter F, as in Frome.
But then, just as they were on the verge of cracking the case, authorities lost the trail of the black car completely. Fox thought that the couple probably slipped across the border into Mexico, taking the Frome's luggage with them, never to be found.
Fox had just missed his chance at catching the potential killers, but he was still determined to set things right.
When we return, Fox redoubles his efforts to catch a killer. And now, back to the story.
In April of 1938, El Paso County Sheriff Chris Fox led the homicide investigation into the deaths of 49-year-old Hazel Frome and her 23-year-old daughter Nancy. He had caught the trail of two potential suspects, but lost them in a high-speed car chase. With his suspect lost in the wind, Fox redoubled his efforts to solve the case before it was too late. He had local papers and radio stations encourage witnesses to come forward, and soon he managed to loosen some tongues.
Maria Baca, a maid at the Hotel Cortez, finally opened up to Sheriff Fox. She shared that she was in the room when Hazel opened the strange, unaddressed letter. Although she didn't speak English, Baca could tell the Frome women were very frightened by what they read.
This was a big turning point for Fox because it explained why the killers went to the trouble of taking all of Hazel and Nancy's luggage. They wanted to recover their incriminating letter.
Another sinister piece of the puzzle fell into place with the testimony of hairstylist E.L. Bradford. He trimmed Hazel's hair on the day before she went missing and told Sheriff Fox that the whole time he was working, a man stood outside the salon, watching Hazel intently.
As soon as Mrs. Frome left, the man approached her and they had a conversation before going their separate ways. While this seemed like a harmless exchange, it was the first clue supporting Fox's theory that someone was following the Frome women before they left El Paso.
One final submission steered Fox firmly away from the highway robbery theory. An anonymous businessman reported that he saw Hazel and Nancy at the Juarez Cafe two nights before they went missing. According to the man, two men approached the Frome women and invited them to a party nearby. He overheard Hazel say that she recognized one of the men from the West Coast.
The man wasn't sure if Hazel and Nancy accepted the invitation, but other witnesses reported seeing the Frome women with two men in Juarez the next night.
Fox's investigation quickly pivoted to identifying these two men and discovering if they could have had a motive to ruthlessly torture and kill two innocent women. He reviewed the entire case file for any clues about who these men were and whether they had anything to do with Hazel and Nancy's murders.
While reviewing the evidence, Fox found witness letters with valuable information about the case that had fallen through the cracks. Chauncey Worcester was driving through El Paso on the morning that the Frome women went missing.
He described passing two women in a silver Packard on the side of the road and seeing two more people standing between the Packard and a smaller car. But most notably, he saw a man exiting the small car who had unusually large eyes.
Worcester's description matched earlier witness testimony of a man with distinctive piercing eyes seen interacting with the Fromes on the side of the road. Authorities ran with this lead, and soon Fox got another break in the case.
The Hotel Cortez finally agreed to provide its guest list from the days that Hazel and Nancy had stayed there. Each person on the register was tracked down and each provided an alibi, except for two men, G. N. Gepka and Dr. Romano Trotsky.
Sheriff Fox did a deep dive on both men. Gepka turned out to be an alias, and it quickly proved impossible to find this man's true identity. But Fox had more luck with Trotsky, an Eastern European con man who'd slipped into the United States. Rangers had records of him operating in New Mexico and Texas.
Using one of Trotsky's many aliases, Fox traced him to Las Cruces, New Mexico, not far from El Paso. Trotsky had recently skipped town, leaving behind his wife Helga and their 17-month-old child. Helga was all too happy to speak to Sheriff Fox and his deputy Shay when they came knocking on her door.
Officers! Oh, thank goodness. Finally, someone can help track down my good-for-nothing husband.
Ma'am, we'll certainly do our best. But first, we have a few questions. Are you aware that your husband has gone by several aliases? Most recently, Dr. Romano Trotsky.
What? Trotsky? No, I had no idea. He's sometimes acted strangely over the past couple years, but I never thought... But I suppose it all makes sense now.
What do you mean by that, ma'am? Acting strangely?
Well, he was always moving us around. Los Angeles, Laredo, the Bay Area, and now Las Cruces. And then he just up and leaves me and our baby with nothing?
Ma'am, do you know where your husband might be right now?
No, I have no idea. He left over a month ago. March 27th.
And what vehicle was he driving at that time?
He's always getting new cars. But I remember he left in a green Cadillac.
Green?
Yes. Does that mean something to you?
It just might. Thank you for your time, ma'am. You've been very helpful.
Fox was excited to hear that Trotsky was driving a green Cadillac just days before Hazel and Nancy went missing. He immediately thought this could be the source of the mysterious green scrape on the Packard's fender. Fox upgraded the con man to his prime suspect.
Unfortunately, Fox had no leads on Trotsky's current whereabouts, but ballistic evidence soon threw a wrench in his suspicions.
The FBI sent Fox a report that the .32 caliber bullet found in Nancy's brain was manufactured in Germany. Specifically, the distinctive slug was used in automatic weapons issued to Nazi elites.
The mystery of the bullet's origin was solved, but other questions loomed. Namely, how and why did a specialized Nazi weapon travel all the way from Germany to Texas and lodge its slug into Nancy Frome's skull?
While Fox puzzled over this, 400 miles away, his prime suspect was about to make a huge mistake.
Ranger Hawkins and Deputy Sheriff White were standing outside a courthouse in San Angelo, Texas, discussing the case when a suspect waltzed right up to them.
Whew, would you look at that caddy? They don't make them like that anymore.
Wait a second. Isn't that a .32? Like the one Trotsky's driving? It's not green, but it sure looks like a fresh coat of paint.
No, you don't think. He couldn't be that bold, could he? Driving up to a county courthouse in broad daylight while half the state is looking for him?
If he's bold enough to murder two innocent women, I wouldn't put it past him.
Well then, let's go get him.
Romano Trotsky?
Yes.
You're under arrest.
Hawkins and White arrested Trotsky on April 29, 1938. Inside his car, there was a surgeon's kit with medical gloves just like the ones Sheriff Anderson found.
State authorities quickly dispatched two investigators to question Trotsky. Fox was thrilled to hear that his prime suspect was behind bars. He assumed Trotsky would soon be transferred into his custody.
Unfortunately, Trotsky spun a new yarn to talk himself out of trouble. He provided an alibi that placed him in New Mexico during the time of the killings. Trotsky convinced the Rangers that, while he was guilty of several small crimes, including illegally entering the United States, he was innocent of double murder.
Rangers confirmed that Trotsky was in Roswell, New Mexico on March 30th and Carlsbad on March 31st. He had borrowed money to fix a minor dent in his fender and have his green Cadillac painted yellow and black.
The Rangers in San Angelo were satisfied that Trotsky was telling the truth about being in New Mexico the day of the murders. But Fox realized the towns where he claimed to be were all within a few hours' drive of El Paso. Trotsky could have been involved with the crime, then driven to New Mexico to establish an alibi. Unfortunately, the arresting officers were not as thorough in checking the timeline.
On May 2nd, Texas Department of Public Safety officers transferred Trotsky into the custody of U.S. Immigration to be deported. Even though he was from Eastern Europe, he was released into Mexico and promptly vanished. The seasoned con man had pulled his most brazen disappearing act to date, and Sheriff Fox never got to question his lead suspect.
After this distressing turn, things went from bad to worse. Just after Trotsky slipped away, Fox received several alarming pieces of information about him. The American Medical Association sent a report on his history, and it was full of complaints of malpractice. Shortly thereafter, the FBI sent along their own file on Trotsky. It was quite thick.
The dossier documented the con man's crimes, spanning all of the United States and some in Mexico for good measure. His offenses included grand theft auto, practicing medicine without a license, and performing abortions, a procedure that was illegal in the United States at the time.
Trotsky would travel from city to city and set himself up as an eye, ear, nose, and throat surgeon under one of more than 30 aliases. From there, he would discreetly offer local doctors his special services in case any of their patients required them.
While he did occasionally perform legal procedures, abortions were his bread and butter. Because of the illegal nature of his work, Trotsky was always on the move, trying to stay one step ahead of the authorities.
The American Medical Association tracked Trotsky's movements and placed him in both the Bay Area and Los Angeles between 1935 and 1937. The con man's presence in California solidified Fox's hunch that Trotsky was tied to the Frome murders. But it also opened up a new possibility that the solution to the case lay in the Golden State.
Sheriff Fox became determined to continue his investigation on the West Coast. This would give him an opportunity to look into Trotsky's possible involvement, and while Fox was out there, he could look into someone else who had aroused his suspicion, Weston Frome.
In mid-May, Fox made an appointment to speak with Weston and flew across the country to meet him. Yet, when he arrived, Weston abruptly canceled their meeting. Fox expressed his frustration to Berkeley Detective O.M. Thompson.
You Detective Thompson?
Sheriff Fox. Chief Greening told me you might come by.
Did he also tell you I'd be madder than a wet hen?
He might have said something to that effect.
Frome canceled on me after I flew out here to speak to him. What is that man hiding?
I'm sorry about that, Sheriff. But I've already questioned Frome. I sent you my notes.
Oh, yes. Thank you for that. But I'm afraid that's not good enough. He's obviously covering something up.
Anything I can help with?
Do you know if Trotsky had a connection to the Fromes? Or why Weston is lying about them staying in Bakersfield when we know they stayed in L.A.?
Point taken. Perhaps you can reschedule with Frome when he's back in town.
Oh, I don't want to set up another date just to get stood up. But you could tell Mr. Frome that I'm not going to drop this.
True to his word, Fox continued looking into Weston and learned that he was more senior at Atlas Powder Company than he let on. Weston was actually the top executive for the entire Western United States. At that level, his work demanded secrecy because he had access to blueprints for Army construction projects. With this new information, Fox began to think Weston might be avoiding him and lying about Los Angeles in order to protect Atlas Powder Company's secrets.
When Fox ran into a wall with his investigation in San Francisco, he turned his attention to Los Angeles, where Weston often spent time on business. He knew he was on the right track when he received a note from the FBI suggesting that he get in touch with LAPD officer L.J. Hurst about the case. Fox quickly did just that.
Lieutenant Hurst, what do you have for me?
I think you'll find this interesting. Records from the Biltmore.
Hazel and Nancy did stay there. I knew Frome was lying.
And that's not all. Frome admits to attending several networking events at the Biltmore. But these parties were a bit more risque than that. Prostitutes were often in attendance, and Mr. Frome struck up a relationship with one of them, Jane Levy.
Well, that explains why he didn't want me looking into the Biltmore.
That's part of it.
Am I reading this right? Weston was being blackmailed?
For 2 years. About $200 a month to keep their affair secret. But he stopped paying a few months back. Reckon Jane was none too pleased about that.
That's unbelievable. This could be the motive I've been looking for.
Thought you'd find it helpful. And one more thing. This Jane Levy runs with kind of a rough crowd. Her husband and her pimp are part of a German gang active in Los Angeles and the Bay Area.
That's some company Frome's been keeping.
Hurst shared plenty of shocking information about Weston with Fox. However, he held back that the FBI and the LAPD were investigating a West Coast Nazi espionage ring operating out of the Biltmore. Not only was that strictly classified, it seemed irrelevant to the double murder at hand. It seems Hurst had no idea that Nancy Frome had been killed by a Nazi-issued gun.
Still, armed with this new evidence, Fox headed back to El Paso, where he continued his California investigation remotely. Fox told Berkeley PD Chief Greening what he'd learned about the blackmail. Greening, however, was under pressure to protect one of his jurisdiction's most prominent citizens and discreetly passed this information on to Weston.
At first, Weston completely denied being blackmailed by Jane Levy or anyone else. However, after a week of continued inquiries from Fox, Weston acknowledged that he had indeed been extorted. But he still insisted the arrangement had nothing to do with the murders of his wife and daughter.
For a moment, after Weston admitted to the blackmail, it seemed the case might yet be solved. But a series of unfortunate events soon stopped the investigation in its tracks. In July 1938, Fox's tensions with the Rangers boiled over, and they stopped sharing leads with him at all. Then they had Culberson County Sheriff Anderson take jurisdiction of the case.
Anderson didn't have the means to run point, so this was likely a ploy by the Rangers to oust Fox and assume full control of the investigation. Then, shortly after the Rangers' coup, the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety died, and his successor deprioritized the Frome case. Fox could not catch a break, and things were about to get much worse. Not just for the investigation, but for the entire world.
Within the next 2 weeks, Hitler made plans to invade Czechoslovakia and perpetrated the bloody Kristallnacht pogrom. As the beginnings of World War II made headlines, the Frome murders quickly faded from the nation's consciousness.
Ironically, the Frome homicides had more to do with Nazi espionage and the lead up to the World War than anyone initially realized.
Up next, we'll hear more about how a German spy ring was connected to the murder of Hazel and Nancy Frome. Now back to the story.
In the fall of 1938, the double murder case of 49-year-old Hazel Frome and 23-year-old Nancy Frome started to go cold. Lead investigator, 41-year-old Sheriff Fox, got a break in the case when he discovered that Weston Frome had been blackmailed to cover up an affair. But before he could run with his new lead, he was suddenly shut out of the investigation.
At the same time, global events were speeding toward a Second World War, with Hitler's planned invasion of Czechoslovakia and the monstrous slaughter of Jewish citizens making headlines. The murders of Hazel and Nancy Frome fell by the wayside. Interestingly, though, there was a possible connection between the Frohm killings and the rise of Nazi Germany.
Throughout the 1930s, as Hitler prepared for war, German spies and propagandists were planted in American communities. Their goal was to steal U.S. military secrets and sabotage the United States defenses from the inside.
Unbeknownst to Fox or the Rangers, in 1938, Nazi spies had Weston Frohm squarely in their crosshairs. Weston was a powerful executive at a massive explosive manufacturing company, and he was of German descent to boot. Nazis were desperate to convert or compromise him in order to infiltrate Atlas Powder.
Werner Plack was an agent of the Third Reich who was perfectly positioned to recruit Weston. In the late 1930s, Plack inserted himself in the Los Angeles party scene as a purveyor of fine wines. He threw boozy parties for major contractors and executives to loosen their tongues, and Weston Frohm was often in attendance.
Through this association, Plack could have introduced Weston to Jane Levy, the sex worker who became his mistress and blackmailer. Or Plack could have learned of the arrangement after the fact.
From there, Plack might have tried to use the situation to coerce Weston to reveal explosive industry secrets from within Atlas Powder. But Plack was disappointed. Frohm was too loyal to Atlas to share any compromising intel.
In any case, the blackmail issue became moot when Weston abruptly stopped paying his mistress and the German gang that she was involved with.
Sheriff Fox believed that Weston's sudden cutoff could have had something to do with the torture and murders of Hazel and Nancy. But after Fox was removed from his lead role in the case, California authorities refused to look into the blackmail connection any further.
With Fox locked out, the case languished on the back burner for over a year as leads dried up and budgets dwindled. By March 1940, the only lawman officially working the case was a rookie Texas Ranger named Hugh Ferries.
Ferries dove headfirst into the massive case file. Soon he agreed with Fox's theory that Hazel and Nancy's murders were connected to California and potentially to Weston's job at Atlas.
Eager to begin, Ferries set up a meeting with Weston for November 1940. This time, Weston couldn't dodge the meeting as he was in a Richmond hospital recovering from a minor surgery. Ferries had a captive audience.
After exchanging pleasantries, Ferries began with a few softball questions to loosen Weston up. Then he went in for the kill.
Was there anyone who would have wanted revenge on Hazel or Nancy?
No, of course not.
We've gotten some anonymous tips that they might have been carrying some kind of government secret. Is there anything to that?
Christ, no. I didn't tell them anything about the explosives business.
I didn't say that you did.
Yes, well, good.
On their way out of town, Hazel and Nancy stopped at a travel bureau and asked for a passenger to accompany them. Did they do that often?
No, that is absolutely not true.
The owner recognized them. He said they wanted a presentable male passenger. Do you think they might have been afraid? Maybe they wanted some protection?
I told Sheriff Fox and everyone else. I think robbers followed them out of El Paso and ran them off the road, and that's all there is to it. I think you better go. If you have more questions, you can send them in writing.
Well, thank you for your time. You've been very helpful.
Ferries left the interview more certain than ever that Weston was hiding something. While the rookie ranger tried his hand at cracking it, Sheriff Fox tackled a new assignment, one that would bring him tantalizingly close to finally solving the Frohm case.
J. Edgar Hoover personally recruited Fox to help the FBI with counterintelligence efforts. By the end of 1940, the Bureau was investigating at least 250 active cases of espionage, and they needed all the help they could get.
Through a wiretap, the FBI learned that an undercover Nazi agent by the code name of Wolf was operating in the El Paso Juarez area.
In an incredible twist, Wolf turned out to be none other than Wolfgang Ebel, the physician who treated Nancy Frohm at the Hotel Cortez back in March of 1938.
This knowledge would have made Ebel a prime suspect in Hazel and Nancy's murders. But tragically, Fox had no idea about Ebel's connection with the Frome women.
When Fox looked into him, 41-year-old Ebel didn't seem like a dangerous criminal at all. But there were several points of interest that linked Ebel to the case. If only Fox had been able to connect the dots.
First, the American Medical Association had filed a complaint about Ebel, reporting that he worked with a traveling abortionist. This fit the MO of one doctor, Romano Trotsky, a prime suspect in the case.
Also, Ebel worked as an assistant at the El Paso Medical Lab, driving around collecting specimens for testing. The doctor did this in a special delivery vehicle, marked with a sign on the door.
This might have been the car with white lettering on the side that witnesses saw chasing the Packard. But at the time, Sheriff Fox was unaware that Ebel had met the Frome women in person. As such, Fox never suspected that Ebel was involved with the murders and never made these connections, which would only be made by amateur sleuths years after the fact. It seemed no officer of the law would ever take note of these intriguing parallels.
Instead, in early 1941, the Frome investigation sputtered to a complete standstill. Just like Fox, Ferries, the last officer on the case, was recruited to join the FBI's counter-espionage effort. Hazel and Nancy Frome's murders fell by the wayside.
Fox dug into Ebel with all the tenacity he had devoted to the Frome case, and soon discovered that the doctor set up safe houses on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border to transfer sensitive material from Nazi agents on either side.
Through his illicit activities, Ebel was in touch with many other fellow spies. He could have called on this network if he ever needed help with a mission. For example, torturing sensitive information out of the wife and daughter of a well-connected explosives executive.
In 1941, the FBI secretly authorized Fox to do recon on Ebel. Fox had deputies sneak into the doctor's home and office to document evidence without leaving a trace that they were there. These missions uncovered even more damning information.
The deputy who broke into Ebel's office immediately noticed a framed, autographed photo of Adolf Hitler. If that wasn't enough of a red flag, Ebel also had a Rolodex of Nazi sympathizers around the El Paso Juarez area.
Meanwhile, two more deputies surreptitiously snuck into Ebel's house to complete a similar mission.
Make sure to leave everything the way you found it.
Hey, I've got something over here.
What's that? A special Nazi gun?
Swastikas on the side and everything.
Well, I think that's planning to report back to Fox.
Yeah, let's get out of here before they get back.
The deputy made note of the gun in his report, but had no idea that what he had found might have helped solve a 3-year-old double murder.
The weapon was a special automatic pistol from the Third Reich, made exclusively in Germany. No one in law enforcement made the connection that this incredibly rare gun perfectly matched the one that took Nancy Frome's life.
It could have been a coincidence that the same doctor who happened to treat Nancy Frome also had a rare weapon of the exact same foreign make and caliber as the one that took her life. But that seems improbable.
Here, at last, was a clue that could have broken the case wide open, but no one recognized the significance of the pistol in a 3-year-old cold case. It seemed like the Frome murders might never be solved. And another development soon made that unfortunate outcome even more likely.
In the summer of 1941, Fox quit law enforcement for good. He left his job as sheriff when he was offered the prestigious position of executive vice president of the El Paso Chamber of Commerce.
With Fox completely off the case, it seemed Hazel and Nancy Frome's killers might never be brought to justice. But Dr. Ebel was about to run out of luck.
Japan bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, and immediately afterwards the U.S. declared war and sealed off its borders as a matter of national defense. Ebel's espionage came to an end, as he was no longer able to smuggle national secrets out of America through Mexico.
As the United States entered World War II, the FBI stopped just surveilling spies and started locking them up. 10 days after Pearl Harbor, a team of federal and local authorities came knocking on Ebell's door.
FBI, get on the ground!
Please, I surrender!
You better surrender, you Nazi SOB!
That's enough, Agent. We got him.
Ebell was taken to El Paso County Jail and booked on charges of espionage. At his trial in July 1942, the Nazi doctor was sentenced to 7 years in prison. Ebell watched from his cell as his precious Third Reich disintegrated.
In the midst of a Second World War, many law enforcement officers decided they could better serve their country by enlisting in the armed forces.
With a nationwide drought on officers, it was barely possible to investigate crimes as they occurred, let alone cold cases. Even one as sensational as the double homicide of Hazel and Nancy Frome. And the case was completely dropped.
Officially, their murders are still unsolved. And that is almost certainly how they will remain. After 82 years, all pertinent evidence and witnesses are long gone.
Unofficially, it seems unlikely that Hazel and Nancy were the victims of highway robbers. This theory doesn't account for the prolonged torture inflicted on the Frome women, or the fact that the killers left valuable jewelry behind.
Strangely, it seems plausible that through a series of unfortunate events, Hazel and Nancy got tangled in a web of pre-war espionage and it cost them their lives.
I think that a Nazi spy ring tried and failed to recruit Weston Frome through a blackmail scheme. Then by chance, one of the ring's key members crossed paths with Weston's wife and daughter while they were alone and stranded in El Paso.
I agree with the espionage theory. Wolfgang Ebell assembled a gang of spies, including Romano Trotsky, to help kidnap and torture Hazel and Nancy. They tried to get information about Atlas Powder Company, but when that failed, the gang killed the Frome women to silence them.
This double homicide was the most costly investigation in Texas history. It also had the largest case file with more than 2,500 interview transcripts alone. The case captivated both professional lawmen and amateur sleuths for over 8 decades. To this day, the murders of Hazel and Nancy Frome are two of the most significant unsolved murders of the American Southwest.
Thanks again for tuning in to Unsolved Murders. We'll be back next Tuesday with a new episode. For more information on this double murder, amongst the many sources we used, we found Fetch the Devil, The Sierra Diablo Murders and Nazi Espionage by Clint Richmond, extremely helpful to our research.
You can find all episodes of Unsolved Murders and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Unsolved Murders, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Unsolved Murders on Spotify, just open the app and type Unsolved Murders in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
If we live till next time.
Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Isabella Way, and Joel Stein. This episode of Unsolved Murders was written by Nani Okwalagu, with writing assistance by Abigail Cannon. The amazing cast of voice actors includes Jen Wong, Joe Hernandez, Dan Velasquez, and Harris Markson. It stars Wendy McKenzie and Carter Roy.